welcome to Comic Talk Today for Thursday, February 7th, 2019. Man, I have got a great episode for you guys today. Joining me on the podcast on this Therapy Thursday, Ted Brandt, Bro Stein. Those names sound familiar. They are part of the artistic team on Crowded. Fantastic book. I highly recommend you go check it out. I've talked about it on the podcast before. I finally got to talk to these two. Very excited. We're going to go pretty in-depth on a lot of things. We're going to talk about the European comic book market. We're going to talk about their process, their long journey from art school to doing comics, and how sometimes being in the right place at the right time is the best way to do it. So without further ado, check out the interview. Hope you enjoy it. I'll be back at the end. Enjoy the show. Good evening.
Hello.
How are you?
We're good, thanks.
Fantastic. Yes. Thanks for doing this so late on your end.
Oh no, it's fine. Like this isn't too bad. It's only 9 p.m. here.
I honestly had no idea what time it was.
I heard somewhere you guys go to bed somewhat early, and I was like, oh man, I hope the time we picked is not too late. No, that's cool.
Look, it's not past our bedtime quite yet.
That's cool. But, thanks for coming on. I needed to, class things up a little bit, so I figured having a couple of Brits on might be, a way to do it.
You might be sorely disappointed.
Are you guys as high energy as what I picture you in my mind?
Depends on the day.
Depends on the day.
Depends on what you're picturing as well.
I've read Crowded a couple times, and, the first time I read it, I was like, I know Chris is a little off the beaten paths a little bit, but just judging by the art style that you guys have, I just picture you guys just extremely outgoing and chipper most of the time.
We're very animated.
Yeah.
Definitely. We don't leave the house much, though.
I can imagine. It's all those panels you guys are doing.
That's yeah. A lot. Yeah.
That's a lot of panels. I was, are you guys familiar with, Kano? I think he's out of Spain.
Vaguely.
So he did a book for Valiant Comics a couple of years ago, Delinquents. And, there were a lot of panels in it, but more recently he had another book that he had done and he wanted to outdo the number of panels. And I think in one page he had come up with something like 87 panels, or it was something ridiculous.
What?
Yeah, because so the original script had a 9-panel grid, and he's like, "Oh, well, I can do like 9 panels within each panel," and so like he played around with it and came up with some structure to this page where like it was something ridiculous. Like, it was like 60 or 70 panels in one page, and I mean they were tiny. I don't know how in the world he did that.
Was it readable?
Oh yeah, it was readable. It was readable. It was fantastic. And the reason I thought of it is, you guys have a page, I can't remember what issue is, maybe issue 1 or 2, in the house, and you have the whole page is the house as Charlie and Vita are walking through. And,
yeah.
And that particular page reminded me of this like insane, like whatever, 70, 80 page panel. I think the way you guys worked this whole thing out maybe worked a little bit better. It was crazy. I saw it and I was like, how is this guy doing this? He's got to be like blowing up the page or like drawing with a magnifying glass or something.
Yeah, probably.
Yeah, I can't even fathom that. That sounds so painful.
Yes, yes. Anyways. Thanks for guys for coming on there for real. I know, most people probably start off, wanting you guys to talk about your origin story. We're not going to do that. I'm actually curious. I haven't had a Brit on this show yet. I've had creators from, Spain, Australia, and a few other countries, but I'm curious to know what comic book culture is like in England.
Well, I can't really answer that question. That was never really my thing, honestly.
Yeah,
that's
sure.
That's definitely a you question.
Yeah, I've never been hugely plugged into it because, although I got into reading comics at age 4 or so, and then superhero comics around like regularly at least at 14. then, like, I didn't go to conventions till quite a lot later on, didn't really talk to anyone in the comic scene in England till much later on. So, but I mean, we've got, it's quite a lot like America, really. You know, we've got fairly mainstream conventions that now cater more to TV and film stars than it does comics. We've got a couple of really good comic shows. I mean, our favourite one is Thought Bubble in Leeds.
Oh, yeah.
Which is a curated show. So, it, you know, everybody applies to have a table there, and then they go over all the submissions and decide who's worthy, which means that it's all 100% comics all the time, which is great. And we've got, like, proper indie zine fair type comicette experiences where it's all, like, super independent self-published stuff. So, I mean...
all stapled by hand.
Exactly.
Oh, yeah,
we've got, you know, the same sort of range as America, just in a smaller space. There's a much bigger difference between the comic scenes in Britain and anywhere in Europe than there is between Britain and America.
Yeah, I've heard that, because I think Diamond distributes their comics in Britain also as well, right?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, we've got a weird system, because we do import Diamond comics, you know, for the stores and all of that, but our, like, our newsagency-type stores also have Panini distributing, like, digest versions
yep.
of the comics. So, like, you'll get one Batman book that, like, has an issue of Detective Comics and an issue of Batman in it. Or there was one that's, I think, still going, Wolverine and Gambit, which is one issue of Wolverine's solo series and one issue of whichever X-Men book happened to have Gambit in it at the time. Things like so we've got a weird selection.
Yeah.
In that, like, that are kind of slightly more accessible. So that was the sort of, that was my first experience of superhero books, which was frustrating because it went, like, I'd never got the full story of anything, because it was really dependent on if that particular newsagent had ordered that, you know, that enough of that book that week, and usually they'd only ever have one or two. So it was things like, I read, you know, when I was young, I had two isolated issues from Heroes Reborn and one from the final issue of the Onslaught saga, but nothing before or after.
Oh, man.
And things like that. It was a very weird thing until I finally got access at 14 to a comic store in Bristol, which is where I was living at the time, that actually had Diamond imported American books.
Yeah, I first heard about that a couple of years ago. I have a friend of mine who's an editor for a publisher in Brazil, and he was telling me that that's the way that they do the books in Brazil as well. They take a couple of issues from different series and they collect them that way, because they don't really have a huge comic book market to begin with. And so by doing these digest type things, they're able to push out a bigger volume, because people see that as, I guess, a better value, maybe, because you have more story. So they're collected almost in a trade, but it's really just a couple of just single issues put together.
Yeah, I mean, the ones here are they're just double sized comics, basically.
Right.
Though they have a much more tough cardboard cover rather than just regular floppy stuff.
Yep.
But yeah, it is literally just two issues stapled together, effectively.
Now that's cool. I read an article in the New York Times a couple of days ago. There's some show in France in Angoulême. And they were talking about how huge the comic scene is in France, and I had no idea. I mean,
oh yeah, I mean they put all of us to shame. Angoulême lasts for a week, but has somewhere between 500,000 and 800,000 attendees.
Wow!
I mean, it makes San Diego look absolutely piddling. They take over the whole city center. I mean, Angoulême in general, like, it's home to the most prestigious comics university course possibly in Europe, certainly in France, and so it's got a long history of comic stuff there anyway. They've also got the Comic Book Art Museum, which is the most amazing thing. They've got four sets of exhibits that they have in there, because they never leave any of the original art out for more than 3 months to make sure it doesn't get too light damaged. But in there you can see classic manga pages dating back, you know, 80, 90 years, then move on to seeing original original printings of things like the Yellow Kid newspaper comic, newspaper strip from America. Then you know, they've got Will Eisner pages, they've got Frank Miller Wolverine, they've got Chris Ware original. I mean, their collection is absolutely staggering and covers so much ground.
See, I had no idea. I started going through this article, and there's like politicians going in there, like comics are considered like a national art in France.
They're called the ninth art.
Yeah, the ninth art. Yeah. It's crazy. It's crazy.
Oh, yeah. I mean, what you got to remember is like they do things in a frankly more civilized manner than the direct market does, which is no single issues.
Right.
You just release a trade every time. And if a series is popular, when it's released, it will immediately be at the top of the national book list. Not like, it's not like the New York Times, which has a comics list and you can get onto the comics bestsellers. We're talking top of the nation's bestsellers.
What's that thing if they don't treat comics as disposable?
Yeah, no, right.
No,
right.
It's art to them.
Yeah.
Like, I mean, you look at one of the few series that has gone properly international, thanks to Dark Horse's international distribution deal, then yeah, Black Sad.
Yeah, like, I just recently read that. Yeah, it's fantastic.
Yeah, but every time a new one comes out, then you get Black Sad is the single best-selling book in France for several weeks. It's amazingly different to how we do things.
Yeah, no doubt. Yeah, there's a lot of interesting books out there. I didn't realize most of them are coming out of France. What's the Humanoids puts out a lot of those books out here in the U.S. And yeah. I think Lion Forge maybe is trying to bring some of those books over. It might be Lion Forge.
Yeah, no, Lion Forge are definitely starting to go that direction.
Yeah. It's fantastic.
And Dark Horse as well.
Oh, yeah, Dark Horse, yeah. They've been doing that for a while.
Yeah. Yeah, there's a bigger push to get European comics in, which is great because, I mean, they are fantastic. And they're just so different to what Americans produce in a lot of ways. Like, you know, because it's so different culturally. And you end up with these really fantastically different reads.
Yeah, it's almost like in America we have more of a pop culture lean towards comics, right? And even though you could probably say that the majority of people reading comics are roughly, I mean, our ages probably. I think you guys are probably a few years younger than I am. But you know, like 20s to 40s, I would say, is where the majority of comic readership is. Maybe even a little bit towards the older end, and you know, into the 40s. Whereas, and you're still getting like these poppy, just kind of fun stories, right? I mean, you can have a serious superhero comic, and you when those books come out, they're critically acclaimed, right? I think maybe that's why guys like Tom King do so well here, because he's telling stories in a very different way. But it's not like it's something new, right? I mean, we've had that kind of book here in the U.S. for 40 years. Right, since the indie scene started popping up here, and you really get, I think, a lot more interesting stuff coming out of the indie scene oftentimes as a result, because they see that comics aren't just a kid's thing. Yeah, the European books are fascinating though. It's almost like reading a novel, but in comic book format, right? Like a true graphic novel.
Yeah, I mean, I would disagree with you slightly that like the idea that it has to be for adults to be interesting or anything like that. Because I mean, like, there's so much scope for all ages work that's brilliant. I mean, look at Giant Days.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. That, you know, that's absolutely a comic, and it is also one of the best monthly books out there. It's, you know, there's a lot to be said for not trying to be, like, adult is one thing, but a lot of the problems that we see in American and, you know, British-produced comics is there's often a mistaking of grimness for adult, which is something that I have never been fond of.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Because, I mean, because again, like, you know, talking about Giant Days, it's accessible to anybody, really. But it's got some quite adult themes, but they're actually adult themes of, you know, like, how to deal with fucking up your life or your friend's life. What do you do when friendships are drifting apart? How do you go from being a teenager to an adult? Like, those are really adult themes.
Oh, yeah.
But they're also delivered in a way that's lighthearted and charming. Because,
and very accessible.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because, you know, I would never argue there isn't a place for grim at all. But is always a mistake to talk about that as if it's the adult approach.
That's true. That's true. Maybe not the adult thing. Maybe more of a, I don't even know how I would describe it. It seems like maybe oftentimes comics get pigeonholed in a certain demographic. And people sometimes shy away from certain books because they're like, it looks a little too YA for me, right? I'm a grown man with kids. I don't need to be reading kids' books. But some of those are really, really fun. I mean, Marvel's put out a few of them. I know, like West Coast Avengers gets some flack, but, I really enjoy that book quite a bit. You know, it's a fun book. Yeah,
I think fun is a greatly underrated quality right now, culturally.
Yeah, we forget to have fun. That's so true. That's so true. Fascinating. All right. No, seriously. I don't get to talk about that kind of thing to a lot of people because a lot of people aren't really interested. You know what I mean? Some people don't even want to have like serious conversations on the direction of comics because they're like, I just want to read my comics and enjoy them. And to some extent, that's fine. But you know, if you really love the medium of comics, then that kind of thing means something to you, right? And you guys work in comics, right? And I'm sure you want to be proud of all the work that you put out.
Oh yeah.
Absolutely.
So, yeah. All right, cool. I had a question for you guys. I don't know if this has been asked of you guys before. Do you guys ever have an issue, spending maybe too much time together out of curiosity?
I think we manage it pretty well. Sometimes we can get on each other's nerves, but that doesn't happen all that much.
No, I mean, it's like anything else. Enough communication will see you through any given problem.
Yeah.
And it can be hard to remember that sometimes if you are in the same room talking all day, but
that's the thing. I think we figured out that you don't have to be talking to each other all the time to be in the same room together.
Yeah, which does help.
Yeah, that does
help. We're quite happy just sitting and watching something and essentially ignoring each other. It's like, yeah, you're there. Yeah, there. I know you're there. I'm happy you're just sat next to me.
Yeah, I often wondered. My parents had a business together. And so, you know, they worked together all day long, and then they came home and they made dinner together and they went out together. I mean, usually when they went out, we came along. But I just always found that interesting for people that work together in a medium as intense as comics too, right? Because you guys are putting a lot of effort in everything. And, I know that you guys have very complementary skills, it seems, as well. I know, Ro, you don't come from really a comics background. Ted, you grew up reading comics, but I find it really interesting how you guys can manage to do that and do it so well. I mean, there's very few couples in comics that work together on their comics. But sometimes you just kind of hit that spark, and I think you guys have that spark. There's another artist couple, Raul Allen and Patricia Martin, who kind of have, I mean, I don't know you guys, right? It's the first time I'm talking to you, but to me seems has that, I don't even know what the word is. Maybe that pizzazz, that ability to work together so well and complement each other so much. And I was curious how your process impacts that for you guys.
It helps that, like you say, we've got complementary skill sets, which means that there's not a lot of stepping on each other's toes. Mm. So that makes things really easy, generally, because all the things that one of us can't do, the other can. So it becomes quite straightforward to get anything done, generally.
Yeah.
I mean,
the hardest part is remembering that you're there. So when I need a hand, I have a tendency to get stuck in my own head occasionally and get stuck on a problem. And Ted has to keep reminding me that he's there to help me. And I was like, oh yeah, that you've made it a lot easier already. Dang it. So that's something I'm still working on.
How'd you guys find the jump to comics for you? And really, I want to know, first of all, why American comics? I mean, obviously with there being a scene much closer to you, what drew you guys to American comics, first of all?
They were willing to pay us.
Ah, that's the key.
Yeah.
Like, I mean, I could wrap it up in all sorts of nonsense, but no, that's what it is. They were the ones who offered to pay us first.
Because this thing, while it might be a passion, it's also what we want to do for a living.
Sure.
So the having the living part is very helpful.
Yeah. Yeah, like, don't get me wrong, any of the British publishers we'd also love to work for, but when we started out, then it was only small American publishers who were interested in giving us a shot, which, you know, we're very grateful they did. But if, you know, if a British one had done it, then we'd have been interested in them too. It's not a, it was never anything specific in terms of direction. It was literally just following money.
Yeah, no, that makes sense. And the first book you guys did was Princeless, right?
Yeah. Yes.
So tell me the story about how you guys came upon that book.
Well, like,
it was you.
Yeah, I mean, we were in a really weird spot right at that point, because the place we were living wasn't working out for us at all. Like, we'd both just gotten out of really terrible illustration agency contracts, finally, and could actually look for work again in art stuff. Mm-hmm. But in the meantime, we needed to eat, and where we were living just didn't have that. So
was that set up through the university?
No.
Okay.
No, it was something that we came across. Because at the end of the university degree, then there was a...
There's an art show in London and to display stuff, and professionals would come around and like give out cards to anyone they wanted to. And so we got approached by someone. We were very eager and signed up without really...
It was you know, that proper thing of a verbal contract isn't worth the paper it's printed on.
Yeah, yeah.
So they made a lot of very grand promises, but then in the contract, all the language was best efforts. And of course, with language like that, if they don't feel like making one, their best effort is going, eh,
right,
and shrugging.
Sure.
And then that still counts. So that was what they gave us for 12 months. Where we each only booked one small gig each.
Wow.
And then, so after we quit the contract, there was still a 6-month cool down before we were allowed to, you know, get any work for ourselves, which was absolutely obscene.
Hmm. Yes, it wouldn't have been so much of a problem if it didn't have an exclusivity clause in it. So.
No, or if they'd done their jobs. Because when we came on, they were all very, oh, we'll work with you to get your portfolio up to scratch and make sure that you're going to be hireable. Most of our agents, most of our artists, sorry, are in full-time work with us, and yeah, horse shit. But anyway, so we, like, you know, by this point we'd just gotten out of the tail end of that contract, but weren't making any money. So we moved back to my parents' house for a little bit with an intention of moving back to Bristol, where there is a lot more work. So spending a couple of months looking for work there and then finding a flat and then worrying about comics once we had an income. But during that time, that was when Jeremy Whitley was posting up about the fact that Princeless Volume 3 had a hiccup. Yeah, had the artist drop out for personal reasons. So he was desperately looking for someone to fill in. And we applied that weekend and got the job.
Wow. Would you just like... send him a DM on Twitter and say, hey, we're looking for work.
Tumblr, actually.
Oh, really? That's hilarious.
Yep. Yeah.
Yeah, that was like, cause that was where I saw it. And so then, so we kind of cobbled together, like, so we'd never worked together before. So we cobbled together a bit of portfolio for each of us and then, like, requested the script so we could do a couple of trial pages. And I think just that request was what got us the job, because no one else thought to ask. So we didn't even need to provide any sample pages. Like, that and a couple of character designs were enough.
That's amazing. That's amazing. I don't even know it could be so easy.
Neither did we.
Sometimes it's a matter of being in the right place at the right time, right?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
No, that's great.
Then, you know, since then, we've had, you know, plenty of ups and downs. So sometimes you're in the right place and sometimes you're not.
Sure, sure. What is it that drew you guys through to Crowded? Because I know Chris was pitching a few things at the time.
We were looking for work, and you were talking to Juliet, our editor, who we already knew previously just from Twitter, right?
Yeah.
And Ted was complaining about he didn't have any work at the time. And she was saying that Chris had some pictures he needed artists for. So she kind of just made an introduction with that, really.
Yeah.
That's how it worked.
And so, yeah, we hopped on Skype with him. He told us he had a list of five things, and Crowded was the second. We didn't need to hear any of the others.
Wow. Interesting. Okay. Yeah, I mean, I like Chris's work. I do a podcast also on Aftershock, so I'm very familiar with Cold War. It's a fantastic book. Hayden's an amazing artist also. He's got a knack for picking the right artist, it seems, because all the books he's putting out on his own really have just terrific art overall, including you guys, of course. That's why I'm glad we're getting to chat. I'm curious, Ro, you don't have a comic book background, but your art is very distinctive, I would say. And I'm curious what your artistic influences are.
A lot of animation, really. Big fan of sort of Corey Loftus and Glenn Keane. And I've had a lot of influence of Ted throwing Stuart Immonen books at me.
That makes sense.
Yeah, I'm just looking at the shelf right now. There's quite a few art of animation books and things.
Yeah, then, you know, more recently, so there's also like classic Disney, all the hand-drawn animation stuff.
Yeah,
Oh, right. Milk Carl and his hands.
Yeah.
It's fantastic.
I was curious because you've got almost, it's not quite anime, but it's got almost that vibe to it. In fact, when I read Crowded the first time, I don't know how familiar you guys are with anime, but
not very.
I used to watch Pokemon.
Okay, yeah, kind of. there's an anime called Foodie Cootie, and the art style seems so similar. And in particular, because I mean, there's some very outrageous sequences in Crowded, but Foodie Cootie just is completely over the top. It's like if you took Crowded and put heroin on it or something, it's that kind of thing. But the art style is also very similar. And I was curious, I know you didn't have comic experience, but I was curious if there was maybe some anime inspiration there as well. I mean, just classic Disney animation, I guess, makes sense as well.
Well, I didn't have really much anime, but I had some of those art of manga books, you know, how to draw manga books as a teenager, remember? I don't remember the books themselves that much, but I remember I had them.
You know, I have one, and I've never even opened it. I bought it.
You might be surprised at some of the nightmares you might find in there.
Oh, I have no doubts. I have no doubts. I bought it like 15 years ago, and it just sat on my shelf the entire time. I've never even opened it. At one point, I wanted to try to start doing art again. I used to do art a lot when I was younger. And I was like, you know what? I like this kind of style as well. Let me see if I can maybe figure it out that way. Never even touched the book. It happens. I guess that means that maybe comics is working better for you guys than maybe a career in animation.
Oh God, no! I couldn't do that animation. I tried doing a bit of an animation course before I went to the university where I met Ted, and it's a great career for people who have a lot more patience than me.
Right.
Because I found it so tedious drawing the same thing over and over again, but only very slightly different. And I probably would have gone mad trying to be an animator.
No, that makes sense. And in particular with you guys having worked on mostly creator-owned stuff. I mean, I know you guys did work at Marvel, for example, but a lot of creator-owned stuff. And I think Crowded has really hit a tone with a lot of people as well. It seems like maybe working in an animation studio might give you less options, I guess, because you'd just be kind of stuck on this somewhat bureaucratic process working animation, as opposed to really, I mean, you guys seem like you're having a lot of fun doing Crowded.
Oh, definitely. I like doing the car chases.
The self-driving car chases?
Oh, yeah.
I love those. It's funny. One of my favorite covers is actually one of the simplest ones. The one, was it issue like 5 or 6? Issue 5, I think, with the self-driving pods.
No, that's on the 6.
It's 6? Yeah. I love that cover because, I mean, if you just see it, you're like, okay, a bunch of cars. But if you read the story, I think it's hilarious. I think it's hilarious. How much influence do you guys have on the story itself? Right? I know Chris is writing it, but surely you guys are putting your own touch on the pages.
Oh yeah, definitely tweak the pages.
Yeah. Chris is very patient with us doing whatever we feel like on the page, really. Like, it's not that we ever try to directly counteract what he's asked for, but we'll often decide that there's a neater or more exciting way of doing something that he's requested. And I mean, in terms of actual story, we've contributed a couple of plot points that will be showing up later and tweaked a few characters, I think that'd be fair to say.
Well, I think it's safe to say that we shifted the tone of the book a bit.
Yeah.
Because isn't there a note that Chris found in one of his early, in his notebook? It was like, comedy? Question mark?
Yeah. Oh, interesting.
Because...
Yeah, I think based on, admittedly, you know, it's been quite a while, but I think that it was originally intended to be a bit more serious than it is because Chris wasn't certain if, you know, because if the comedy would be able to be communicated enough through the art.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's almost,
we just kind of insisted.
The central themes of the book are they're pretty serious, right? I mean, you have that social media angle, but really it's about people being terrible. I mean, that's ultimately what the book's about. And even the main characters aren't really nice people.
No.
Right?
Absolutely not.
So, yeah, I wonder how that would have gone were it a serious book. Maybe it might have been too much seriousness.
I'm not sure it would ever have been, like, serious, but it definitely wouldn't have been as outright comical as we've made it.
Yeah, I like when you guys put in, what was that one store, like Kickstander or something? I can't remember.
Kickstarter.
That's it. when I started catching those little things in the background, I was like, okay, there's something else going on here. And I really dug it. Matter of fact, in the first issue, there's a panel that I loved, and it's so simple. When that old lady is chasing after Charlie, and she like spills the cup of coffee, and the coffee spells out splat on it. I just love that. I just love that kind of thing.
It's fun playing with the lettering for that kind of thing.
I'm sure it is. How much freedom does Chris give you guys on layouts, for example, on the book? Now, I mentioned that one page. Complete? Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like, there's very few times when he insists on anything. And even then, we still have a fairly free rein. Like, I think the closest he ever came to insisting on something was page 13 of issue 1, the house cutaway.
Mm-hmm. Oh, that was Chris.
Well, he said he wanted us to be able to see inside the house.
Gotcha.
But that's what I mean when I say that was the closest he ever came to insisting on anything, because it was still entirely our game to work out how to implement that.
I love that page. That's fantastic.
But then he called the shots in terms of where they needed to be walking and looking at, and
I think we might have tweaked that a little bit in places and where they were walking to make, because he described a basic layout of the house and sort of where they should be at certain points, and we nudged them into maybe slightly different places in the house to make it work with the flow of speech and stuff.
Yeah.
So
yeah, it makes sense. I often wonder, because I mean I've seen all kinds of scripts. And obviously you guys are privy to more because you're in the industry, so you actually see final scripts. But, you know, folks like Fred Van Lente, for example, they'll post draft scripts on the stuff on their websites. So people that want to know kind of how to structure their stories can get some information. And there's a couple other guys, maybe like Ron Mars and a few others. And I often find it interesting to see, like, the level of detail that a writer puts in how the page should be structured. Because I've seen something as simple as, you know, like, do whatever you want, to like really intricate descriptions of like every single board on the wall or like a scratch on a wallpaper or whatever. I'm sure it's probably more rewarding for you guys as artists to have a lot more freedom in the way that you're allowed to structure your page.
It definitely means we can end up with a product that we find more visually appealing. Yeah.
Yeah.
Because, like, while we enjoyed our Marvel work, then that was much more rote than Crowded is. We had much tighter constraints on us, and that was fine. But we rarely ended up with pages that were so visually interesting in and of themselves. It was the books we worked on, at least, were much more a writer's book than the artist's.
Right.
Whereas Crowded is much more of a joint effort.
Do you think that's maybe partially due to, like, editorial say?
I wouldn't want to speculate, honestly.
Yeah.
Because,
sure.
Like, we only had such a limited time just doing small bits and pieces for them.
Yeah, because it's not like we're ever a big thing of a project. We usually were pinch hitting on stuff.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Everything we were doing was a case of just filling in if somebody else couldn't make a deadline rather than. So, we didn't really get a traditional experience of what working for Marvel would be like, I suspect,
mm-hmm.
because we were getting a very different experience to most of the artists who work there, who are doing a stable gig, where we were just coming in at the 11th hour to make sure that a book went out on time.
Yeah.
Quite literally at one point, we were given one page to do. It's like, if we need this page done today, and the other artist isn't...
They were sick, weren't they?
Something like that. And it's like, he's got the thumbnails and everything ready for you. We just need penciling and inking. I was like, oh, okay. Here you go.
That's not as bad. Especially, I guess, maybe with the way you guys are working. I mean, do you guys just... That's the only book you're working, right? Is Crowded.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. I've started doing a bit of side work at the moment, but...
He's faster than me.
But it's taken up to this point to get to a position where I could sustain that, and because Crowded is so demanding.
Oh, I'm sure. With the number of panels and, oh man, I can only imagine.
Well, that's our own fault.
Well, yeah. but you guys want to make something you're proud of, right? So why not put your best effort in it?
We're always pushing to be better.
I'm assuming you guys are maybe working on the next arc of Crowded.
Yes.
Do you guys, that hasn't been announced yet, right? When the next arc will be? I know the trade comes out next month.
Yeah, trade comes out in March. There was a slight hiccup with scheduling, so issue 7 comes out in June.
Okay.
So you guys had to get pushed back a month just due to some slight scheduling conflict.
No, that's fine. I mean, you guys are working on it, so that's good. How far ahead do you guys try to stay on this?
As much as possible. I mean, there's no other answer, really.
Yeah. We're not organized enough to have a concrete answer for that.
And also, because Crowded is what it is, then, it's each page varies so much in difficulty. It's very difficult to plan out exactly how much time anything will take.
Sure.
So we do our best. It's that thing of, the first issue of the arc, we've got all the time in the world. And by the last issue of the arc, we're suddenly going, oh God, where's all the time gone?
Now, it's good that the book has been well received, though, because you guys can continue working on this thing. And, it's obvious that Chris really enjoys writing it. I heard on another podcast, he was saying how much time he's devoting to it because he really does love it, right? I mean, he's always working on like 5 different books.
Yes, the man is a madman.
He is. Well, but it's also probably a little easier for a writer, right? Not to demean the art of writing, but doing art on a book definitely takes a lot more time. And you guys are probably slightly more fortunate because, I mean, bro, you have an inker, right? A lot of artists don't even have inkers anymore. They're inking their own stuff. Some of them are, even lettering their own pages. And you guys have a little more flexibility with that, where you can really concentrate on your end of the craft.
Oh, yeah. I think it really helps to be able to do that. Because, as I said before, each part of the production of the book is a part of a conversation. And if you've got more people doing the different parts, you've got more people involved in the conversation.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, there is a certain amount of envy for people who can ink themselves from a financial point of view.
Because
then, they get to take home the whole paycheck all themselves.
Yeah.
But then because we live together, they, you know, two people can live almost as cheaply as one. So it's not so bad.
Sure.
From that point of view.
Sure. No, that makes sense. How do you find Ted, being predominantly an inker? Cause it seems like inkers don't get a lot of love for some reason.
They really don't. And it is a big shame. Like, but I couldn't be a penciler, honestly. And, you know, my brain doesn't work in the right way. I can't generate visual ideas consistently enough. Hmm. Whereas refining and taking what someone else has put down and actually, you know, finishing that off, that's something I can do and love doing. It's a real joy. Near the end of last year, in November, I had my first professional inking gig on someone other than Roe, which was a fantastic experience, actually. It was really great. You know, it was the first time I've actually had a paid opportunity to ink somewhere else, and I'm just in the process of starting another side job at the moment, and it's great. I mean, like Roe said, it's all part of a conversation.
Yeah.
And
you enjoy having other people to talk to.
Inking is, I mean, it's a joy to do. And if you ever, I don't know if you ever watched any of the videos someone like Sandra Hope puts out.
Oh, sure.
My God, just watching her work, even if it's only for a couple of minutes at a time, it's just staggering. I mean, that's a level of craft I just flat out do not possess and probably won't for another 20 years, but.
It's actually really interesting talking to, like inkers, colorists, and letterers. Because for example, like on a podcast, when do you generally see any of those guys on there talking about a book that they worked on? Right. They usually have a writer or oftentimes an artist as well. And so it seems almost like when you have an inker, a colorist, or a letterer, I don't know if it's maybe they're more eager or if the fact that you don't often hear about the type of work that they're doing. You just see the final page, right? Because you can see the words and you can see the art, but you don't take into account all the other steps that go along to make this finished product. Whenever I talk to one of these guys, it seems like there's always some profound thing that they say that I never thought about, right? And you mentioned watching like videos of people inking, for example. I mean, having like a colorist talk about color theory is something that I never would have thought about just reading a comic until I actually had the experience of speaking with a colorist and talking color theory. Because there is a lot that goes into making pencils, for example, a finished product. And it's fascinating.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, yeah, it's a really important skill set. And I mean, it's one of the reasons why I think it's a shame that the page rates in comics, you know, aren't rising in the way they should be, because that's part of the reason why we have fewer inkers right now. And also partly is there is also a cultural element to it, which is that it's very difficult for a company to think it's worth hiring an inker if reviews only talk about, you know, the pencil as lines. Because,
yep.
I mean, most of the time, in reviews of Crowded, then they'll talk about Rose line art, and it's like,
or sometimes your line art by or your colors, because they've confused people.
yeah, sure, but that's like, but that's kind of secondary to the point that here, which is that it's very easy to see how inkers can become culturally obsolete if someone looks at the finished line work, which is what I delivered,
right,
and say, oh well, that's all Rose work. It's like, yeah. To some extent, but it's also mine. Well, if another person inked it, if Roe inked it, if another inker inked it, it would look very, very different.
Yeah.
And it wouldn't be Crowded.
So there's a couple issues with that, right? I think number one, a lot of people that review comics don't really understand how comics work. It's just guys that really love reading comics and want to talk about these comics. And so, again, what they see is the letters on the page and the art. And they don't take into consideration all the additional stuff.
I'm really not trying to blame anybody at all.
No.
Yeah, but it's just you know, that's the way the culture is going, and so it does mean that I think that is at least a contributing factor to why inkers are a lot less prominent and valued in the industry than they were 20 years ago, yep. much less 40.
Do you think that some of that is maybe related to a lot of guys going digital, guys and girls going to digital art?
I don't know. I mean, because, like, the thing there is that what you're talking about, if you're someone who's inking themselves, is that, like, their pencils are likely to be super rough, and then they'll ink, like, they'll actually do all the drawing in the ink stage. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. But then that's definitely not limited to digital, because you look at Somni's work, and that man draws the roughest balloon shapes. They're anatomically accurate balloon shapes, but they are only balloon shapes that he'll do in pencil.
Yeah.
And then he draws it all in ink. So it's not endemic to digital at all.
Hmm. Makes sense. I hadn't thought about that. Yeah. Yeah. I love Sammy's art though. He's got that, it's that like classic comic book feel, right? Like straight out of the Silver Age. It's fantastic. All right. I don't want to keep you guys much longer because I know it's late over there. One final question. Anything you guys want to tease about what we can expect on this next arc of Crowded? Will there be more self-driving cars?
Oh, yeah. So let's have a think.
Other means of transportation as well.
Oh!
There'll be a lot of action. There'll be...
interesting interpersonal relationships.
Yep. We'll definitely be digging much more into Charlie and Vita's pasts and starting to get a much better handle on why, not just who they are, but why they are.
Love it.
There'll also be more dog.
Yeah. is that based on one of a dog that you guys had?
No, one I saw based on teacup chihuahuas, because I saw a picture of one on some social media somewhere and I thought they looked so grotesque. These big bulging eyes. You have to put them in.
That dog's got a lot of personality. A lot of personality. Alright, out of the two central characters, who would you say is your favorite?
Oh, as a character or to draw?
Well, either one.
Hmm.
Mine's Vita on both counts. I'm always fond of people, like, you know, characters that are very stony on the outside and soft on the inside. And just as characters, and there's something really pleasing about all the hard edges to Vita.
Yeah, she's fascinating, especially with the little tidbits of background story that we get through the first six issues. She's by far my favorite. I mean, Charlie's hilarious. She's a hot mess, but Vita is just, there's something about her. I just want to know more.
Yeah, we'll be connecting with both of their pasts a lot more in Arc 2.
Fantastic. All right, I'm going to let you guys go. I want to thank you for your time, and thank you for doing this so late again. Anywhere people can find you, aside from social media?
I've got the Twitter, and I've got Instagram, but I don't really use that very often.
No, best place to look up might be our website, brantonstein.com, because as of tomorrow, by the time your listeners hear this, will be a couple of days in the past, we'll be starting to sell the original art from Crowded Arc 1.
I saw your tweet. That's exciting.
So first up is going to be the
covers
from the arc, and then we'll move on to issue 1 interiors.
By the way, I want to compliment you. I know it's the last names, but that is a fantastic website name. It sounds so like, I mean, I don't want to say British as an insult. That is the highest compliment I can give you. It sounds like a like tailored suit company. I love it.
Well, it's a tailored name.
Oh, sure. Yes. Yes. I am aware. No, thank you guys again for coming on. And Crowded is fantastic. I can't wait for more. And the trade comes out March 20th, yeah?
I believe so, yes.
Awesome.
Oh, glad you knew.
Oh, man. Look on Amazon.
That's right. Oh, man. All right, cool. Thanks for your time, guys. I really appreciate it a lot. I'll be putting this out on Thursday of next week.
Cool.
Fantastic.
Awesome. Thanks again.
Thanks for having us.
Have a good night, guys.
You too.
Bye. Bye.
And that's going to wrap up this episode of Comic Talk Today. Thanks again to Ro and Ted. They were absolutely fantastic. Of course, I'm glad I had some Brits on there because you got to class it up, man. I mean, I live in the South. I'm not very classy. So thanks again to those two. Be sure to check out their work and check out Crowded. Go ahead and get the trade. I guarantee you will really love it. Of course, if you want to get in touch with me, the best place is always on Twitter, at Geekvine. You can email the show, yell at comictalk.today. That's it. Dustin will be back tomorrow with Comic Talk headlines. I'll be back on Monday with the top of the pile. Enjoy your weekend, and I'll catch you then.